This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this virtual space, we'll meet people who know what they're talking about and who can give us all the answers to the big questions of the moment. And whether we're brilliant or execrable or could just do a bit better, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're asking, is it possible that there could be a further referendum on Britain's relationship with the EU? And if so, what would the process be to making it happen? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. In recent podcasts, we've covered student finance, the prospects for a new British political party, and what might be at stake in the US midterm elections. 2 years ago, it all seemed so simple.
It's a single decision, it's a final decision, and there are only two choices.
2 years on, it's anything but.
On June the 23rd, 2016, we voted to leave the European Union, but we didn't yet know at that point what the terms of the new relationship would be. Once we know those terms of the new relationship, we are surely entitled to think again.
And what that means, say a growing number of voices, is a further referendum. Some people don't agree.
This government will never accept a second referendum. The British people voted to leave the European Union, and we will be leaving on the 29th of March 2019.
But what PMs say doesn't always go, and the idea is in the ether. Here in The Briefing Room, we're not going to discuss whether it's a good idea or a bad one. That's not what we do. Instead, we're going to get briefed on the practicalities. How might a referendum come about? When could it take place? And how would it be organised? What might the question be? And how might the rest of the EU respond? These are all very hypothetical questions, but they're all out there, and in the next half hour, I'll be getting answers to them. First, how did we get from a situation 2 years ago when Brexit meant Brexit to one today when many politicians, campaigners and even European prime ministers are talking about holding a further referendum on Britain's relationship with the EU? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Chris Morris, who's been covering Brexit for BBC's Reality Check. Chris Morris, where did the idea of a further referendum originate?
Almost straight away after the 2016 vote, there was a burst of support. There was actually a petition before the June 2016 referendum, actually put forward by Leaver, which said that we should have another referendum if fewer than 60% of people vote either way. So that was a Leave supporter, if you like, hedging his bets. Within days, it was signed by several million people once the result was known. And there was some dispute about whether some of those signatures were accurate, but nevertheless, an awful lot of people signed up very quickly.
Now, where do the political parties stand on the question of a further referendum?
Broadly, they're split, but I mean, the government and most of the Tory party ruled it out completely. Just this week, Theresa May has very firmly come out again and said there will be no second referendum. Labour's position, I think, if you were being polite about it, is more nuanced. They say nothing is being ruled out. They respect the outcome of the referendum. But there are certainly implications in there, and this is an official party policy, that if, for example, we were facing a no-deal situation, then everything should be on the table. That's kind of Keir Starmer's line. Within the parties, of course, there are people who dissent. I mean, there are some fairly prominent Tories. The former minister, Justine Greening, for example, has called openly for a referendum. There are leading people in the Labour Party, Sadiq Khan just recently. Within the trade union movement, there is a growing body of opinion that's saying referendum should be a good idea. And then, of course, you have the Lib Dems and the Greens. And in Scotland, of course, the SNP, very early on, Nicola Sturgeon, who is not unknown for favouring second referendum and all sorts of things, said, we need another vote because Scotland voted to remain and we need to have another say.
Yeah, and so one of the things that you're suggesting has happened is that there's been a kind of campaigners' campaign, really, which has been independent of the political parties themselves.
Yes, and so now, I mean, there were various different pressure groups, if you like, emerged from what was the campaign to remain in the European Union, the group Britain Stronger in Europe, sort of split into various bits. I'm generalising here, but it's now sort of coalesced in this one group, really, which calls itself People's Vote. And they have become more prominent, they've become more organised, they've held rallies around the country, they hold local rallies, signing people up. And so it is a fairly well-organised campaign, but it's not one which has formal party political support at the moment.
Now, what can we say from polling and other evidence about the attitude of voters, as far as we can judge, towards a further vote?
You talk to pollsters and they say it depends very much on the type of question you ask them. There's some polling evidence to say that if the choice is between no deal and having another referendum, then support for a referendum increases. But I don't think it's yet a decisive switch in mood to really affect national party politics in the big parties.
Is there anything in the demographic of those being polled that is interesting?
There is, and it's something we saw, again, in the June 2016 vote. 65% of over 65 voted leave, 75% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted to remain. And obviously, a lot of people who were 16, 17 2 years ago would be able to vote if there were to be another referendum. There's also an argument about whether the franchise should be increased anyway to allow 16-year-olds to vote in another referendum. The argument is obvious that if you had a greater number of young people, then clearly support for Remain would probably grow, and support for some sort, depending on what the question is in a referendum, but support for not crashing out, certainly, of the EU would grow.
It's pretty obvious why people who voted to Remain might like a new referendum and might feel kind of energised by it. I presume that the feeling would be pretty different amongst those who feel strongly that we should leave.
There is concern about that. I mean, I think this is probably an issue which has split British politics and British society like kind of no others in our lifetime. And people talk about culture wars in the United States over issues like gun ownership and abortion. Brexit has become our culture war. Andy Burnham recently said, he'd previously said he didn't think there should be another referendum. The mayor of Greater Manchester, prominent Labour figure, said in extremis, if the alternative would be crashing out, then I would support another referendum, even though I would be worried about the prospect of unrest on the street. So it's certainly something that is in people's minds.
Chris Morris. So if there were going to be a further vote, what are the necessary first steps to making it happen? Who decides and how long would it take to organise? With me now is Alan Rennick, Deputy Director of the Constitution Unit at University College London. Alan Rennick, what would have to happen to trigger a further referendum?
In order to have a referendum in the UK, Parliament has to pass a law. It's as simple as that. So Parliament has to pass a law that indicates what the question is and also sets out various other things. The franchise, some of the rules for the campaign, the rules on how to count the votes, that kind of thing. That's what happened for the 2016 referendum, and that's what would have to happen again.
When you say setting the rule for the franchise, what does that mean?
We don't have any legislation in the UK setting out what the referendum franchise is. So every time we hold a referendum, the law for that referendum needs to state the franchise. Normally, it is basically the parliamentary franchise. In the 2016 referendum, it was the parliamentary franchise plus members of the House of Lords, who, of course, normally can't vote, plus also people in Gibraltar. And probably this time it would be the same again. Some people have argued for extending the franchise to EU citizens who are resident in the UK or to to 16 and 17-year-olds. But there are very good reasons for keeping the franchise the same as it was last time, so we have a kind of comparable referendum process.
Is there an argument for saying, well, we had the 2016 referendum on this basis of franchise, so we'd better, if we were to have any further referendum, have it on the same franchise basis?
Yes, I think there's a very strong argument for saying that. If you change the franchise and then the result of the referendum is affected by that franchise change, then you delegitimise the result of that referendum.
Now, let's suppose for a moment that people in Parliament did want a further referendum. How constitutionally does that fit in with what we're already doing in the Brexit process? In other words, the moment that Article 50 matures and we actually are said to leave the European Union.
Well, it would be very difficult to hold a referendum before the date we're due to leave the European Union. We in the Constitution Unit have been doing some calculations on this, and we think a referendum takes about 22 weeks minimum from when you introduce the legislation in Parliament to the voting day. If you were to try to hold a referendum before the 29th of March, that means you have to introduce the legislation into Parliament by the second week of October, allowing for Christmas. There is not the slightest chance that that is going to happen. So practically speaking, a referendum would have to take place after what is currently defined as Brexit Day. So you would need to extend the period that is set by Article 50, the period for negotiating Brexit.
And can you do that?
Yes. So in law, it's perfectly straightforward that the period can be extended. Article 50 sets out how that is done. It requires the unanimous agreement of all of the member states of the European Union. All the indications coming out of those countries is that they would be happy to do that in order to allow the UK to hold a referendum. It wouldn't be easy. The biggest trouble is that we've got the European Parliament elections coming up at the end of May, and if the UK is still in the EU, then legally speaking, we have to hold those elections. So potentially we're holding elections for positions that will never be filled if there's a referendum in June and we've left the EU before those MEPs actually take up their seats. So it would be difficult to hold that election, but that's a political difficulty that people would have to deal with. It's not a legal block.
Can I ask you what might seem like a silly question? If you were to have a further referendum, one of whose options was to remain in the European Union, do you have to agree to hold it before the date at which we are said officially to leave?
You at least have to have extended the period before we leave. So you have to make that decision while we're still in the EU. If you make that decision once we have already left the EU, then it would, of course, be possible for the UK to rejoin the EU, but that would be a very complex process and it would require us to go through the whole accession procedure that any non-EU country would have to go through. And in that case, a lot of the advantageous terms of the UK's current EU membership would be on the table. So our rebate, for example, would be on the table.
Now, in the past, am I right in thinking that almost always where referendums have been called by Parliament, they've happened as a result of the government introducing the bill? Are there any exceptions to that?
There's a sort of exception to that, which is the 1979 referendums on devolution to Scotland and Wales, where the government didn't want to hold a referendum. It simply wanted to create the assemblies in Scotland and Wales. But there was a lot of opposition in Parliament, and a referendum requirement was introduced in the process of that going through Parliament. But even there, the government actually introduced the legislation to have the referendum, because it's quite a complex thing to hold a referendum. You can't just have a clause in the bill saying there will be a referendum. You need to have all the rules of the referendum as well. So it really requires the government to introduce that legislation for the referendum, even if the initiative comes from backbenchers in Parliament.
Alan Rennick, and Alan, please stay with us. So Parliament has the power pretty much to decide everything. Joining Alan Rennick and me are two experts who can tell us what else would need to be done to get a fresh referendum underway and what some of the pitfalls might be. They're Professor Catherine Barnard, an expert in European law and a senior fellow at the UK in a Changing Europe initiative at King's College London, and Professor Matt Vortrup of Coventry University, who's specialised in the study of referendums. Catherine Barnard, if we're talking about a further referendum, what kind of referendum are we talking about? Would it be essentially the same as we had in 2016?
Actually, that's the most difficult question of all. Nobody really knows the answer to that. And there are as many views as there are people advocating a second referendum. So at its most simple, it would be a two-question binary choice referendum. But in fact, there are probably three questions that need to be asked. Assuming Theresa May does get a deal of some sort on the Article 50 process, then that will also be accompanied by a political declaration. And collectively, that would be the deal that Parliament would have to vote on. Now, if there's going to be a second referendum, the question is, do you ask three questions, which would be leave on no deal terms, leave on the deal that Theresa May has negotiated, or remain? Now, depending on what side of the debate you're on, you probably would say, perhaps as the people's vote would say, you should only ask two questions, which are remain or leave on Theresa May's deal. But you can see that leavers, who are not in favour of this at all anyway, but they would say, well, that's not right, because people should have the full choice, which would include leaving on no deal at all.
Matt Vautrop, how would we go about resolving that question?
Well, one thing one could look at is how it's worked in other countries. And one of the problems is when you have the multi-option referendum, it's very rare that any of the options would get more than 50%. And there's a rather curious example of Puerto Rico, where they had a multi-option referendum on whether they should become independent or a US state, and they ended up voting for the option that was called none of the above. And we might add that to the list. So having simple multi-option referendums is rarely a good idea. They tried them in Sweden. It hasn't really turned out that well. Another possibility, you could have like a two-staged multi-option referendum, where in the first referendum, we narrow it down to two, and then we have a runoff. They've had that in New Zealand.
Oh, what, like the French presidential election?
Well, sort of like a French, the referendum version of the French presidential election. Now, that's quite complicated, but in a way that would lead to a more fair outcome. At least you would have the most popular options competing with the most popular.
So who's done that before?
They've done that in New Zealand on the electoral system.
They said, do you want to change it or not?
And do you want to change it or not? And if so, which one do you want to go for? And then there was a second referendum where they had a choice between the one that they'd chosen and the status quo.
Alan Rennick.
Matt's described there, firstly, a simple first-past-the-post referendum where you just allow people to vote for one of the options and whichever option gets more votes than the others wins. That would be a really bad way of running a referendum, because there's the danger that no option has a majority, and then what do you do? A two-round referendum is also very problematic. And one of the suggestions, for example, has been that you have, in the first round, you say, do you accept the deal or not? And then in the second round, you say, if people haven't accepted the deal, OK, so do you want to leave with no deal or do you want to remain in after all? So say you're a Leave voter who really wants to leave without a deal. Well, what do you do in the first round if you think that in the second round, remain would probably defeat the no deal option? Do you actually vote for the deal? So you end up with all these really complicated, horrible tactical voting decisions. There are various other options. So one thing to do is you could have a preferential ballot where people are asked on the ballot paper to number the three options in order of their preference. And then there are various different ways in which you could count those votes in order to get the clearest majority winner. Probably doing it that way would be the sensible way, but it all gets very complicated.
Catherine Barnard, who composes the question? Who actually decides? In my mind, I'd always believed that somehow the Electoral Commission did it because they were thought to be impartial and so on. But I wonder if that's actually true.
What happened in the 2016 referendum was that there was the bill contained a draft question, and then it was tested by the Electoral Commission. They do some research, they do testing with the public to see how they respond to the questions, and the question might get tweaked as it did in the 2016 referendum. And so when the bill became an act, it became the EU Referendum Act 2015, you have the final version of the question.
Matt Vautrop, earlier we heard from Alan Rennick, who's still with us, that the timescale for organising another referendum is very challenging. Is there any way we could overcome this?
Well, I'm slightly puzzled by this sort of, we haven't got enough time. I learned on Monday that the Romanian Constitutional Court has decided there should be a referendum on the constitution there to basically ban gay marriage. That's taking place on the 7th of October. So that's only a couple of weeks. So I think, you know, I mean, maybe that's the administrative prowess of the civil service in Romania that is infinitely superior to ours. But I, if they can do it in 3 weeks in Romania, I'm not an expert in public administration, but surely we should be able to do something like that here.
I think much depends on how much we would do a cut and paste of the EU Referendum Act 2015. If we said the franchise would be the same, that is the people who can actually vote, if we said the various dates will be mirrored in any new referendum, of course it would be quicker to do. That said, of course, lessons have been perhaps learned from the 2015 Act. The franchise has always been highly contested. You'll recall that the franchise allowed Commonwealth citizens to vote, but not EU nationals who've lived in the UK, and conversely, UK nationals who've lived abroad for more than 15 years, arguably the two groups most affected by any decision. So there would be tremendous lobbying that they should be included. A further question, what about 16 and 17-year-olds? Again, people who by definition will have the longest period of time to live with the result of the decision.
So if you wanted to do the thing quickly, the more quickly you wanted to do it, the more closely you'd mirror the franchise you used last time.
Absolutely.
Because there'd be a big row and it would cause delays if you tried to vary it.
And of course the argument would be that the people's vote campaign were trying to cook the results of the referendum to get the franchise to best suit the outcome that they most want.
Which was what was said about the Scottish referendum in 2014. Matt Vortrup, how long can you extend Article 54 to give yourself a window within which you can hold a further referendum?
Well, I think the Europeans, you can sort of pause the button, really, and you can wait for a long time. And I think what is interesting now is that Donald Tusk has said that even up to the very last moment, you can press the pause button and you can wait. The other logistical challenge that would emerge if they were to press the pause button is that we would then also have to have European elections, so European Parliament, which was due next year. So we wouldn't just have to have the referendum, we'd also have to have those elections. Again, you know, if there's a will, there's a way. But it would add another complication to it.
So let's be clear about that. We wouldn't know at that point the result of a further referendum, but we'd still have to have the European elections.
If we're paused, basically, then we're still within the European Union. And if we're in the European Union, we have to abide by the rules. And the rules are, them rules can't really be changed, I think, as regards elections to the European Parliament, because then we wouldn't be represented. It hasn't happened before, so I think that there would be a possibility of extending it almost indefinitely. But I think it would be on the understanding that there would be a referendum soon afterwards.
Catherine Barnard, a lot is said about how people who voted Leave and believed that their decision was going to be carried through would be likely to react in the eventuality of effectively a rerun being forced. Now, of course, it's impossible to predict, you know, things like civil unrest and so on, but I presume it's possible to predict that people will take up all the methods of civil redress they think they have against such a referendum taking place.
So it goes back to the question that we were looking at before about, for example, the franchise. Because if the franchise was changed, then presumably those on the Leave side most likely would be the ones who would challenge those decisions in the courts. Now, as we saw in the 2016 referendum, there were in fact a number of challenges to various decisions and the courts rejected them all. But all of it has got the capacity to delay the process. And if you wanted a quick referendum, I think this is unlikely to occur. Certainly, I think it's extremely unlikely it all could be set up in time for the 29th of March 2019, which is why, of course, the question of extending Article 50 becomes relevant.
Alan Rennick, do you think that there would be significant legal grounds for anybody to challenge Parliament's decision to hold a further referendum at all, which would delay the process?
We have very few rules on how referendums can take place in the UK, and even such rules as we have can always be changed by Parliament in the course of passing the legislation for a further referendum.
So in the end, as I sum up on this, it depends on the determination of Parliament and the balance of argument in Parliament, how soon a referendum could happen and exactly what would be asked in it, and that's it.
It depends on Parliament, but Parliament is always going to be very sensitive to public opinion and the impact of whatever it decides on public opinion. And I think Parliament would be very cautious, for example, of trying to hold a very quick referendum, such as Matt has suggested, because the danger there is that it can be portrayed as illegitimate by those who are on the losing side of that referendum.
Catherine Barlow, is that your reading of it as well?
I think that's absolutely right. The people who are pushing for a second referendum obviously are those who are very concerned about the outcome of the first referendum. And that's why they are arguing for it. But if there was a second vote, then, and it were to go in favour of a Remain outcome, then of course there would be calls for a third referendum, sort of best of three.
Catherine Barnard, Matt Vortrup and Alan Rennick. Finally, no island is an island. Other people would have decisions to make. So what would the EU make of any serious moves towards a further referendum? Joining me now down the line from Salzburg is the BBC's Europe editor, Katja Adler. Katja Adler, if there were to be a further referendum called in Britain, how do you think the Europeans and Brussels would react?
It's not part of their plans. They see it as wishful thinking. It would be welcomed if it happened, but they're ploughing on ahead with Brexit negotiations because they look at UK law, and the law states that on the 29th of March next year, the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. I am poking, if you like, my contacts in the European member countries, as well as in the Commission, the whole time, and saying, what happens if Parliament rejects a deal that Theresa May make in Brussels, but it's rejected back at home? What happens if there's then a general election? And of course, then what would happen if there were to be a second referendum? Now, they're not really planning for this, as I say, but under EU law, okay, when a member country wants to leave the club, there are 2 years allowed for negotiations. And that's why everyone keeps saying time's running out, time's running out. But also under EU law, there is a clause in there, if you like, that if all the 27 EU countries and the European Parliament all agree, so it has to be unanimous, you can either extend that negotiating period, you could also freeze it. And so that is thought to be the likely scenario. Were there to be a general election, were there to be a second referendum, then EU member countries, who, as we said before, are very keen for us to change our minds and to stay, would freeze the process and let the UK deal with its domestic politics. Now, big picture, the EU would love us to stay. More immediate term, they want to get rid, if you like, of this divorce process ASAP. Why? Because the EU has other business to attend to. Even at this Salzburg summit where I am at the moment, Brexit isn't top of the agenda. The migration problem between EU member states is. The EU is heading towards what looks like a very fraught election for the European Parliament next early summer. And that's what they're focused on. It looks like a fight between the more populist Eurosceptic forces and the traditional political forces more pro-EU. And they're worried about that, and they don't want Brexit to come into that. So they really don't want to drag this divorce process out. But were it to come to a second referendum, they would put everything on hold.
Now, they put everything on hold. In the circumstances of a further referendum, Katja Adler, how do you think they feel it would impact upon the negotiating process itself?
If before the end of this official legal negotiating process, the UK were to change its mind, under what conditions would it return into the EU? The fact that the UK could change its mind, nobody disputes that as long as we're in this negotiating process still. But would it have all of its old advantages, or has it now given it up? What about the rebate? You know, the famous Thatcher rebate? What about all of our opt-in or opt-outs on justice and home affairs? Have we lost that now? Would we have to sign up to the euro? Now, the official answer is possibly. The realistic answer is no. If we were to change our minds right now, we could come back in as we were. I mean, I'd say I was 99% sure of that. Once we've actually left, though, on paper and legally, and then we change our mind, that is another reason. The EU would let us back in, of course, but it would be a much more complicated process, and there would be much more debate about whether we would be allowed our old treats back, if you like, because other member states would then say, well, what about us? We never got a rebate. We never got special treatment like the UK did. We want it now. And I think the EU is facing so many internal divisions over migration, over the rule of law, like with Poland and Hungary. It cannot afford to fiddle and faddle with its regulations so much for the United Kingdom.
Katja Adler. So how do I sum that up? Well, yes, it would be constitutional to hold a further vote, and yes, there are precedents, but yes, too, deciding what it would ask would be complicated and deeply controversial. My thanks to Catherine Barnard, Matt Fortrup, Alan Rennick, Chris Morris and Katja Adler. We'll be back next Thursday. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The producers were Neil Koenig, Siobhan O'Connell and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. It really would be good to hear from you.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.